on the chart represents what the blended rate would look like, or the equalized rate, if we went through the process of establishing the downtown equalized cost pool and distributed charges back to bureaus and tenants based on that equalized rate. So what this tells you in a glance really is, you know, where would people win and lose, if you will, or what would be the impact of that associated with this change in methodologies. And what I've done in the following table is roll those out in terms of costs to funds and bureaus, not about what the different approaches would be. So we have on the left column, we have the bureau or the fund. We have 2016 unequalized rates. We have 2020 unequalized rates. And then we have 2020 equalized. And what it's important to note is that when we did this spreading of cost, we spread the cost so that it's fully loaded to the bureaus or funds. So we have the direct costs associated with, say, the Portland Building Project and the underlying cost of the buildings. And we've also taken those space-related costs and have run them through the general fund overhead model and our interagency rate models so that you see the effects of those additional spreading of costs to bureaus and funds. Because if we didn't do that, you wouldn't see the full impact of all of these building-related costs coming back to bureaus and funds. We also just note that in 2016, the general fund portion does reflect the fact that almost $2.3 million of debt service is paid as a direct cash transfer for City Hall. And this is the last year of that debt service payment. So what you can see is what happens between these different options. Well, one, between 2016 and 2020, with the Portland Building Project coming online, there's a large cost increase. The general fund is pretty much unchanged, but it would have gone down otherwise. We have in the budget now about $2.5 million of ongoing that have been made part of the current year adopted budget. But you can see the impacts on other bureaus. Transportation increases by about $2.7 million. Development services would drop under the individual cost pool approach. Why? Because debt service on the 1900 building falls away. Environmental services has about a $2.1 million increase. Water about a $3 million increase. And then there's a variety of impacts on other funds. You can also see then what happens under the equalized cost pool. And what tends to happen there is that when we're blending that rate and distributing that back out to bureaus, it tends to dampen the impact on transportation and water and increases the impact to some extent on development services because they're not seeing the benefit of those rates dropping because the debt service reduction of the 1900 building isn't conferred directly to them. And that's always been the challenge of that, is that at any point in time, there could be a bureau that wins, or there could be a bureau that loses. And we have a system now that everybody wants to be a winner. And so as soon as the Portland Building debt service would roll off, they'll want to be back in the building because it's cheaper. We shouldn't have a system set up that incents people to engage in behavior that long run is tougher for us to manage and doesn't allow us to get to a prudent way to manage our assets for the least cost long term. And incents people to be in our buildings where we know by being able to provide that space that we can lower our cost in the long run and have more predictability and stability. So this is kind of an example of what these different options might mean and what it would mean for us in terms of being able to implement that and move it forward. So at this point, I'll stop. I want to close it. A couple other comments I want to come back to, but thought it open up for discussion.
Do you have a proposal for how to make this more fair? For example, development services has been paying a lot more and would not now the benefits of that. The City Hall residents have been paying a lot more, and now they're going to be asked to continue to pay a lot more. That just doesn't seem fair.
Well, the City Hall ones are the easiest one because the general fund's been paying that. So the general fund would pay that, has paid that historically, and going forward, they'd be paying it as well. So that impact is pretty much just a wash. I think the issue for development services is that their rates and charges are based around the current set of rates of costs that they have. I don't know that they're planning a rate decrease into 2020 and beyond. One thing that we can do in setting and moving to a different methodology is recognizing that at any point in time when you make a shift in methodology changes, that you have the potential to create some instability by people that might have been depending on a certain methodology. We could phase that in. We have now this, we're already 4 years out before we would implement this. We could attenuate that to a larger degree if we wanted to, about blending the rates in over a longer period of time to create a little more stability and predictability as well. So I think there are some ways that we could look at managing that so that some of those effects are dampened. But the bottom line that we have to look at is that at any point in time, you can make an argument for not doing it or you can make an argument for doing it. Long term, my recommendation is that it makes sense for us to treat all of our properties as a single cost pool in the downtown and set rates and charges against it as a result of that.
So if I could follow up to either the CFO or the CAO. So I get that if we have a city policy that says we want to encourage people to use city-owned space, that within that framework, a equalized model to me makes some sense, because we're saying you have to use the captive space, and then we're saying that we're going to level out winners and losers and say it's one pool. I understand the logic of that. The fear that I have is that people look at the winners and losers, look at the data, and make decisions about long-term planning, including opting out altogether of the Portland building. So how do we ensure that everybody's in, and there's no option here for the Portland building of people creating new spaces, either building spaces or renting spaces outside of city-owned space?
I think that's what the council does with this kind of decision. Because if we had a situation where the losers, quote, would go to other buildings, and there's no reason why we want to get into a project where we don't fill up the building. I mean, this is hard enough work to make this into sort of a spec building and hope we can get other tenants is the wrong approach, I'd say. So somehow or other, I think you need to make the decision on equalizing rates and not having that perverse disincentive to move out in the short run and then want to move back in the longer run.
Yeah, I appreciate you putting it that way, because it seems to me there's two questions. One, do we want to move to this cost equalization model? And two, are we going to adhere to council policy that we maximize city-owned space? And does that mean that the current tenants are going to continue to be tenants? Because it certainly changes the discussion if all of a sudden we start looking at people opting out. And there's certainly the risk of then spreading those costs in a way that I would consider unfair throughout the pool.
Worth noting, I think, that the green line, the 2020 equalized rates, compare favorably to private sector market rates for Class A and B office space.
When you look at the table, though, on page 6, the big loser is development services. And actually, yes, we have calculated that into the expected permit fees and such. So that, I think, is unfair, that we're actually asking development community through permit fees, because it's a fee-funded bureau for the large part. It doesn't have a big general fund component, and I just don't think that's fair.
It's water and DES. I mean,
that's right.
So I know, but it's not general fund. So
well, they're not really much of a winner or loser, if you look at the table.
Well, in the long run, they're not. I guess, again, to return to the bigger picture question here, to state the question maybe a little differently, is it possible for OMF to proceed with the renovation / reconstruction of this building if we don't have certainty about the bureaus occupying it? I think not.
Well, can't we also achieve that certainty by fiat and say that these bureaus are going to be here? And the bureaus that will never be in the Portland building maybe shouldn't be part of the cost subsidy? Because that's what this really equalization is about, is to subsidize the renovation of the Portland building. I mean, BDS is probably never going to be a tenant. I mean, I don't know how much room you have. Do you have room for a BDS? Do you have room for a housing bureau plus all the other bureaus? I mean, so it seems to me one option is to, and perhaps a more equity-based, is just the council to figure out who's going to be there. And they remain there, and they pay the higher cost. And the bureaus that don't have any pretext of ever being in the Portland building should continue to pay under a cost model that's based on the cost of their true cost of their space.
A couple thoughts, and it's always the difficult time about you pick a moment in time, and you can see what looks fair and what's not fair. So, for example, at the moment, it looks like it's unfair to development services. But let's imagine a situation where the Portland building is financed and debt service rolls away at a point in time, and it will. And that 1900 building is going to need a major improvement. I mean, buildings go through a cycle, and there's a major cost. All of a sudden, their rates are going to go up. because they're not in the cost pool. So do they want to be in the cost pool then when they have that chance to be a winner? It's more of a, I guess, a philosophical question. And the same with outside leases is that at a point in time they might be cheaper. At another point in time they might be more expensive. If they're in the equalized cost pool, they get the benefit of that pool over the long run. So at a point in time, you can find a winner and a loser. The longer run, I believe, everybody will benefit. And that's really, as a perpetual owner of space and a provider of those services to our citizens and owning space and planning for that, I think that's the right model to move towards. Now, how we get there, the time frame we get there, what we include, I think those are all parts of the discussion. But I think this approach of everything standing on its own and creating maybe incentives that don't really allow us to get to that long-run goal of managing our space intelligently has its flaws, and we're seeing it right now in terms of dealing with this particular project. Because if we had done this before, it wouldn't be an issue that we'd be struggling with as much. So I do believe it's the direction for us to move in it for lots of different reasons.
Can I wholeheartedly second that? I think that we've had an irrational policy that results in the city operating in silos and at cross purposes with itself. And whenever government abandons an irrational policy, it's going to hurt somebody who is benefiting or expects to benefit from that irrational policy. But that doesn't mean that we keep the irrational policy in place. So I think what you're suggesting is, you know, at cross purposes with our city history of operating in silos, and therefore is a great idea.
Well, and to amplify that, if at some point in the future we discover that there's a huge structural problem or other problem in the 1900 building, we are going to look back and say, isn't it more fair that that be shared, that that cost be shared, and not one particular bureau that just happens to be there stuck with the tab? I mean, it's what's good for the goose is good for the gander here. But Mayor, to the point about equalization and bureau plans, what I would ask you to consider following this work session is to ask each bureaus what their 10-year plans are. I've been on the council long enough so that I remember the Bureau of Development Services talking about building something in the Central East Side. I've heard rumors of parks wanting to move to Gateway. I've heard discussions about transportation, thinking about options. And really, this begins to break apart if instead of adhering to our underlying framework, which is we maximize the use of city-owned space, people are going it alone and moving to other space, because I think the whole thing starts breaking down if we do that. And we collectively have to reaffirm that principle or not.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, I saw Commissioner Salzman's light on. I was waiting.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay, I realize you can't make a decision on that. We heard a variety of perspectives. I think we need to come back, capture what we learned, and get you to a decision, because I do think we need to say we will have tenants of the building. Okay.
And perhaps our advisors who are developers could work on that with the Development Review Advisory Committee and see if you're willing to shoulder the costs of equalization.
We have included here community benefits. I don't know that we want to spend a lot of time on that right now. Betsy's prepared to do that. But in summary, you have some guidance that we should explore community benefits agreements. Water has done that with a couple, and it's not clear that our numbers in terms of MBE and WBE and so on are any better, but it's time-consuming and expensive. Parks has done something called a community benefits plan, and I don't know. I mean, those things are just in progress, and you're awaiting a analysis to see what they look like. In this project, what we're getting to is we'd like to at least capture the direction from what you're trying to get at on community benefits, whether apprenticeship programs or MBE, WBE. I'm personally not convinced that what we have on the table right now in terms of the community benefits agreement or plan is the best way to do that. So I think what we need to do is come back with how we're going to incorporate those values in however we approach it. And having said the best stuff, Betsy, do you want to add a few things there? You've looked at this.
But aren't we required to by policy? It's The only reason we're not doing it for the parks projects is they're not big enough. But the city policy says that for projects over a threshold, we are going to do a community benefit agreement.
The council did pass a resolution a couple years ago with a model community benefits agreement and went forward with a couple of pilot projects. It is to consider for projects over $15 million in size. We certainly want to be incorporating approaches into the Portland Building Renovation Project that meet the goals and the outcomes that people are talking about. We also, there's been a lot of input recently through the community plan or comprehensive plan process that the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is working on. A lot of community members have been engaging and bringing up different types of community benefits and opportunities that they'd like to see in redevelopment projects. So there are a number of things that we're trying to look at. Our contracting policies already incorporate a lot of that. We want to look at how we can maximize those opportunities and learn from BPS, maybe meet with some of the representatives of the coalition that's formed and has been discussing them with them. Also want to talk with PDC, who's been doing a lot of work with the community about different models that could be used, high road agreements, other types of agreements to get at how you mitigate for some of the past actions and make sure that projects are benefiting the community more broadly. This is, as you'll be hearing, we're looking at doing a design build process, which is a little bit different than our typical CMGC processes and construction-focused projects. So it's going to have both design phases and construction phases, and the existing models really focus on that construction phase. We're also looking at potentially having over $1 million based on kind of the formula for community training, outreach, recruitment and capacity building, and for technical assistance. And the Water Bureau projects have had the contractor managing those. Parks Bureau projects have been having grants that go directly to community groups. So we want to look at the best approach for getting that kind of money out to the community to really enhance the opportunities and kind of grow the pipeline of folks in the community that can actually participate in construction projects moving forward. So there's a lot of discussion yet to be had. We need to make some decisions about the approach prior to going out for the procurement process. So in the next couple of months, we'll be having further conversations with various groups, with all of you, with city attorneys, et cetera. So.
Okay, I want to make sure we have enough time for the last piece, which is future. I'm not going to desert the next one, Betsy, but to talk about how we're proceeding, the public involvement piece. And I want a special piece just to talk about data center and disaster recovery, because that's not part of this project, but it's something we need to do. And Carolyn can speak about that as a separate component. Let's spend about 4 or 5 minutes on the challenges and opportunities. And I don't think we have to say much about that it's a complex project. If you look at your sheet there, complex, and that the construction cost, inflation, and space availability for our employees are challenges. The more interesting pieces are what Betsy will address on historic preservation and the multiple city policies we need to weave through.
So, as you know, it's a historic building. We will need to go through historic design review as part of the process. And as we've looked at various policies that the city has, some of those things may come in conflict moving forward. It's a lot easier to start from the ground up and be able to design everything exactly the way you want to meet our various goals and objectives. It's a little bit more difficult when you're working with an existing building and when you're working within the constraints of historic landmarks review. When we have our design and engineering consultants on board, they're really going to be helping us with detailed analysis. So if there are, you know, really hard choices that have to be made, those will be identified, and we'll be able to bring those to the council and to others for decisions. One of the big things that we've talked about a lot is the windows on the building. They are single pane tinted. They have no thermal break to the outside, so in the summer it's extremely hot. In the winter it's extremely cold. They aren't energy efficient, and they don't provide a whole lot of light into the interior of the building. So one of the priorities moving forward is we really want to have more daylighting, we want to have energy efficiency, we want to have temperature control, and really create a much better working environment for all the employees that are in the building. But at the same time, we might have some conflicts with the historic requirements that look at having replacement with the same materials or managing the same materials. There's also interior walls that are behind the facade glass. So on the outside, it looks like there's more windows than there actually are on the inside. Opening up those interior walls would let more light out at night, might change the look and appearance. And that's another thing we'll have to work through with the Historic Landmarks Commission. And, you know, obviously we'd want to replace the windows with double pane windows or more energy efficient windows, replace some of the materials around it because that's part of our water intrusion and other problems as well. And then we have the bird friendly policies, and that's one area where the lack of windows probably helps us, but the choice of what types of glazing we get will be important to consider there as well. Another area that we've talked about, bike parking. We currently have quite a bit, but the green building policy calls for a 25% mode split, which would be over 325 covered secured bike parking spaces. Our original plans looked at having 75 in a secured locked space with additional parking around the perimeter of the basement garage. Haven't done all the design and work on that and whether it might displace some of our fleet parking, some of our spaces where we have electric charging stations for our electric vehicles. We've had some considerations of moving some of the ground floor retail towards the street, filling in the loggia, because the loggia is not a very inviting, welcoming place, and it's hard to kind of see those businesses in there. That could free up some space in the interior for some ground floor bike parking or locker facilities, but it also could run into some challenges with landmarks because we're changing the exterior of the building. ADA is a big priority for us on this building. As Marina mentioned, the transition plan has identified a lot of barriers. Facilities had some challenges with the historic requirements because of the doors, the main doors to the building, not being able to replace those. They're very heavy, and we currently only have one ADA accessible entrance at this point, and that's clearly not acceptable as we go forward, that it can be difficult to get in to the building. So there's a lot of things like that that we're going to be working through in the design and engineering phase. There might be some choices where there's cost premium. There might be some choices where we need to make arguments to the Historic Landmarks Commission that could be appealed to the council, where we're saying that it's more important for us and for certain goals to meet those goals rather than some of the strict historic preservation options. So unlike the Edith Green building, which could put an entirely new skin on the outside, we're not able to do that, but we're going to try to do as much as we can to make it more energy efficient, more livable for all the folks that live in or that work in the building. Sometimes it feels like living there.
We're fortunate that Michael Graves, not long before he died, came here and voluntarily appeared in front of 200 people at the art museum, and questions were asked at that meeting about the ground floor, about the windows, and so on. And he said, if you cut it short, have at it. Mm-hmm. I realize the limitations, and I'm not going to stand in the way of what I think most people would regard as improvements to the building. So the Landmark Commission heard that loud and clear.
So,
are experts on how we are proceeding, and so you need to know what they know, and then I think that could generate some good discussion as well, and probably also from our advisory committee.
Good morning again. My name is Kristen Wells. As Elisa Kane mentioned, green building is about what's possible, and we're here to try to come up with a project approach to show you what is possible with the Portland building. We have had lots of research, lots of discussion, laying out the goals of the project, and what we have come up with is a very collaborative design-build approach as our recommendation as to how we move forward. It's been suggested by the advisory committee and by city staff. One of the advantages is that it will allow us to think outside the box. Through going design build, we have everybody in a unified contract. The design team and the contractor will be able to have a very iterative back and forth process, looking at creative solutions to all those conflicting issues, looking at the move out, move back in, what can we do? Do we phase it? Do we move everybody in and out all at once? There's a lot of flexibility by going through this process that as a team, as a project team, we'll be able to look at lots of different options for you. The other huge advantage is that we'll be able to achieve an earlier GMP. The dollars are real. The costs are incredibly important. Being fiscally responsible as a city is, as we all know, a very high goal. And so by going through a model such as this, we're going to have a very complete early design phase that we talk about policy decisions, we go through programming, and really define with the entire team that's going to be there throughout the project as to what we want. And we will come up with a GMP that is reliable and well vetted and is earlier in the process than a typical CMGC model would allow us to get. The document going around is showing kind of a timeline outline of how this process would work. You'll see that the first step is we're going to bring on an owner's consultant who will assist in the design build construction solicitation. They'll provide oversight throughout the project and also input throughout the project. They'll become part of our project team as well. Once we get that entity on board, we'll be able to go out for our design build solicitation. We'll move through the first part of phase one, which is this design process, the iterative design process, as I mentioned. We'll be coming back to council. That first pink diamond there, then we'll come back to council and we'll be talking about the pros and the cons and the cost comparisons of the different levels of sustainability, making recommendations on how we should move forward, looking at the various options around the first floor. We'll have talked with the Historic Lands Commission and really have an idea of how to move forward. We'll move into the second half of the phase one, which is criteria design. It's an expanded schematic design process where we'll be defining systems, we'll be defining all of our major materials, we'll be clarifying the historic preservation requirements, so that at the end of that phase one, we have that solid number. We'll come back to council and ask for project approval. We will have that the GMP as well as all the other costs related to relocation and what that will need to be. At that point, we would ask for all the funds to be allocated for the project, and we can move forward into a focused design phase of the project to come up with a detailed design, working to back to that GMP number consistently. At the end of what is labeled there as phase 2A, we would be complete with our construction documents. We would be coming back as a check-in with council, confirming the GMP price with you, and execution to go forward with construction. That's when the contractor would start to actually buy the various materials and supplies to start the construction process. No. So that's basically how the project would be structured, but based on our recommendation. At the end, our intent is to deliver a historically preserved, sustainable Portland building that serves a more efficient workforce for our city. And it really is about what's creating what is possible.
So in terms of the more efficient workforce, and this is for everybody, has there been discussion of whether the bureaus that are in the Portland building now are the right bureaus to be in that building?
I think that's definitely a discussion that's been started that we'll be continuing to have. It plays into the equalization of rates questions. Mm-hmm. It's really something that we do need to solve through this process.
Good. So I'm glad that's being discussed.
And as Betsy mentioned, there's lots of possibilities here as to what the Portland building will be and how will we use the Portland building. You know, the rate model that Ken presented, you know, is there a way that we actually reduce our footprint per bureau and perhaps our square footage per person ends up going down because of the way that we utilize our spaces.
And by the way, unless I missed this, Ken, you were going to talk about when you need a council decision about the rate option, either in chronological time or with respect to this critical path.
Yeah, I don't know that my particular need for that is on the critical path. Obviously, a lot of the decision about we're going to do this project, it's going to look like this, and here's the cost of it. The rates kind of run alongside of that. I think the key thing for me is that the idea that we're going to move towards the equalized model. Here are the people that are going to be inside the cost pool for the equalized model. Here's the time frame that we would use to implement the equalized model. When we start getting a lot more of the details of cost and tenancy and things like that, I will simply drop that in to a particular approach and be able to generate what those impacts are. I think for me, those are the key questions, but they're not necessarily as time critical as some of these other things are, in my opinion.
I do think it's critical, though, that we say we do have a building loaded with employees. I mean, at some stage, we need to get that, and we'll have to bring that back to you when you can make a decision.
Other questions?
So who are some likely design build teams that we would end up with? You know, names.
Christine Moody, Procurement Services. As far as design build teams, I'm not quite sure who might propose on this as a construction management team. I'm sure some of the large general contractors, Hoffman or Skanska or some of Howard S. Wright, as general contractors may look at this and put together a team so that they can go through the whole design process and the construction. So as Betsy was saying, this is a bit different than our typical CMGC that have been to council a lot over the last few years. This is a team that will come together as one team and work with us as the owners to have this collaborative process. Therefore, as Kristen was saying, we're hoping it's going to be a lot faster and more accurate when we get that GMP.
So does the team include the project architect then? Is that chosen as part of this design build team?
Yes.
So typically the architects, the engineers, all the entire design team and the contractor, they'll come together ahead of time, they will propose together, and then we will select the team as a whole.
Our advisors may have some thoughts about that question and also what we might do to make this a more attractive prospect for more competition for that design build, that solicitation to get more proposals from more contractors.
Yeah, I think that it's imperative in my experience of building a high rise that you bring a team on early and you figure out who that team is, because they're going to work through this entire process and figure out the problems as you go along and what it would cost. The only caution that I would bring forward about this particular graph is I think that I would have the big GMP diamond to be a little smaller earlier and have the larger one more to the right, because I think in my experience, you're going to really not know that final cost unless you've really estimated greatly more towards the end of the CD process, because that's really where the rubber's going to hit the road and where they're talking to the subcontractors, because things may change as you go through the city process and the city engineers and all the approval processes. Things happen all the time, so I think you should be aware that the real costs are later on. But I think it's critical you have a team in early that's looking at the issues. I think John's absolutely right. They're the ones that are going to be able to look at early, is there a possibility to keep people in the building or not, and know how that's going to work, develop some rough costs, and then later on when you finally get through the CDs, exactly what that's going to cost.
What do we think the activities in phase one will cost altogether?
We haven't yet put together the model, the estimates as the phase one cost. The $3.75 million that you guys have allocated already to start the beginning planning phase of this project, that will get us a good way through it, but likely we will be coming back to ask for additional funding during that, before executing that design-build contract.
And part of our approach is hiring this owner's consultant here right now, and they're going to help us kind of define help us with those definitions of what phase one is, and hopefully help us refine those costs a little bit more.
So talk to me some more about how we're going to select the design team. As the mayor just said, how do we make sure that more folks are eligible for it? How do we get up front into the community benefits agreement before we're so far down the line that we're not going to be able to open up this major project so that a lot more people benefit from it?
So I think what we've talked about, and Kelly will talk a little bit more about this, is our public outreach. So there's a lot of people that know about this project. It's been highlighted over the last several months in various media organizations. I know that personally some of the large contractors around the area have been asking about it. So in addition to that, we will be doing public outreach about the solicitation itself. That's a little bit separate than just the project itself. And then of course the networking opportunities to allow the subcontractors and the minority and women contractors that may be able to participate on this project, having that opportunity to have conversations with those large general contractors.
And at what points are the council involved? Are we okay, the owner's consultant? Are we okay, those subcontractors?
So there are several points where we'll be formally coming back to council, or as a check-in as part of the project schedule. So the owner's consultant will come to council for approval of that contract when we have that complete. The findings and exemption for the design build process will need to come to council before we actually go out for the design build RFP. So,
and how will you make those choices? This is different again from CMGC, so what criteria do you use to decide who to select?
The criteria will be similar as far as our RFP criteria. A lot of it will have to do with some policy decisions that we need to make between now and when we're issuing that solicitation.
So perhaps council should be involved in that too, if we're setting up a whole new system. I mean, whoever is selected is going to be based on what the criteria are.
Might be useful for the, I want to later on in the discussion get you to talk about milestones and where you're going to need council guidance and action. However, on this particular point, there are, having worked in that world, there are firms that specialize in being an owner's rep in a major capital project. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be able to write fairly standardized criteria, RFP, for what they're seeking, among those firms. And then again, it gets into the, we can create an environment in which the firms that we really want to be on the design side stay out in the design build teams, and the owner's rep that we really want advises us, because that's a bright line. You can't work on both sides of that line. You're either the owner's rep or you're in a design build team. You can't do both.
So given the challenges that we had with the two previous community benefits agreement projects, I hope that we will get an owner's consultant who is an expert in equity and how to direct more business to more partners. Like to know what the criteria are going to be. It's not just how many bazillion other projects have you done that have turned out just splendidly for the majority of folks, but how have you done in making sure that the minority folks have been involved?
I know the adage about letting sleeping dogs lie, but I think we should hear a little bit from Tom.
Two very short comments. Fred will write them down, and he'll read them back to you and to his staff occasionally. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, this will be the most complicated project any of you are ever involved in. Absolutely so. Second, the earlier in the process that the final budget is set, the happier everybody will be. It's about the only thing Bob and I would probably do slightly differently. There will be untold explanations for things that, quote unquote, had not been anticipated early, which are now added to the scope, which add to cost. And I could predict with certainty, if today we are talking something in the range of a $200 million project, if we delay setting the budget, you ought to be thinking in the $250 to $300 million range. I say that based only on experience. Two examples that would amplify that. Two largest projects I personally have ever been involved in were West Side Light Rail and the Convention Center. And in both of those, we set the budget prematurely, way too early, drastically too early. And the only thing that happened was that we completed both projects on schedule and within budget.
So you're saying, and I think this kind of plays to something I'm concerned about just from the dialogue, is we have to have a hard cap. We have to have somebody empowered to say no, because all these goodwill processes we're going to embark on with our external community, with our own rep employees, are only going to result in us, if we're the ones left to say no, in saying yes, oh, it's only $5 million more to put in an extra 500 bike spaces or something like that. I don't know. I'm just making numbers up. But the dynamic is there. If we're left to be the decision makers, the ones to say no, we're not very good at saying no, especially to, you know, internal stakeholder processes and external stakeholder processes and landmark commissions and all their constituencies they will bring to bear on us. So who is going to be the one, not us, that... And I fully agree with Tom, set the price early and stick to it. But there's got to be somebody empowered that's not us to say no to all the little change orders that will come through these processes. So
sure,
who is that?
Very straightforward. You will set the budget, and that is then instructions to Fred. And Fred will be here until the day the doors open on the remodel. And Fred will say, the budget is X. And it is not to be adjusted at all. I'll give you one more example on that.
I would actually concur with that. That's a separate issue from what I was actually talking about in terms of what the components will actually cost to get the work done. And the point is when you actually figure that out, and you may have increased construction costs, some of the values and competing interests that you're going to have, there's going to be some very difficult decisions more towards the end as those flesh out. So I think, you know, in my own projects, I definitely set that budget, but I realize that those budgets are going to have trade-offs, and that's something that you should know ahead of time.
We have an example on the West Side Light Rail, a small issue that the tunnel, as anticipated by the geotechnic engineers, just flat wouldn't work. And in a $945 million project, the cost overruns on the tunnel alone were in excess of $100 million. And people asked Tuck Wilson, who is our project manager, obviously this then adjusts the total project budget. You can't have a 10 or 11% increase in one component. When does that get addressed? And his simple answer was, the general manager does not care if this project ever opens. At the point that we have spent the last of the $945 million, the project stops. It's very clear to everybody. Everybody had a vested interest in having the project open. The project came in at $945 million. It is a unusual discipline, but with the assemblage of the right team, clarity from the council, to Fred as the project manager, it will work.
I'm reminded to say that Mr. Wilson took the same approach when we did the new Columbia. Tuck is famous for keeping organizations on track and getting to the right outcome. Perhaps we should consider bringing him as an honor rep.
I will. There's a cautionary note. I mean, I'm a lot older than Tom, and I was around when the
but you've had an easier life.
Yeah, exactly. Admittedly, when the Portland building was done, and it was a comedy of errors. The city set a budget. There was only one team that met the budget, and therefore that team got the job. And as a result, you've got single pane windows that or the kind of things you'd see in a storefront. I mean, it was a real travesty, and the city was just not expert enough to understand what they were getting at that point in time, and they've paid a price for that. So, yes, the building got done, and it was within budget, but it was a vastly inferior building, and the city didn't know it at the time.
Very good, counsel. Both of those extremely good. All of your counsel has been very good in this session. I want to make sure we have some time for city council questions and requests for additional work, because first I just want to thank all of you for the work that's been done so far, both our external advisors and our internal staff work on this really big, expensive complex. I agree with Tom, even having been involved a little bit in the West Side Light Rail, this one might, despite the slight difference in numbers, be more complicated. But I really appreciate both the volunteer and professional work that's gotten us to this point. And now it's a good time for us to put some requests on the table or post some big questions.
I think that's a good way to spend the time. We can do the disaster recovery data center later, and nothing Kelly will say on public involvement will surprise you. I mean, we've got plans, and we can get that done. So I'd love to hear any comments you have or things we should come back with, because there's a lot of work going on, as you appreciate. Even though you got some decision points coming up, the only way we're going to get it done is by moving ahead as we are.
Yeah, and I would like to explicitly save those two pieces, because obviously this won't be our only work session on this subject. So, Commissioner Fish, you had some things to put on the table?
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I have a plea, a comment, and a question in that order. The plea is that as part of our planning, we think creatively about how to activate the second floor space of the building. When you think about it, we have two public buildings side by side. This building has this magnificent chambers, which is used during the day and in the evening for a public purpose. Next door, there's a second floor with a number of spaces which are really terribly designed and very uninviting. And there's a common space that you walk through which is a disaster. And since this is a public building, which, yes, houses our valued employees and provides services, is also a public space, and one of our goals should be to activate it. That second floor is a real challenge. And so I hope we're thinking very creatively about how to turn that into a community asset. I think the bones are there. I just think the design worked against us. A comment is that
I want to compliment, follow on what the mayor said, and compliment Fred and your team for putting on the table, I think really in a comprehensive and understandable way, the questions, the issues, and the sort of decisions we have to make. I kind of feel right now like I felt the day after I took the bar exam. Unfortunately, a week from now, I'll have forgotten everything that you've told us, but I do for a moment feel that you have helped us understand the sort of menu of questions and policy choices and decisions. And these are some hard issues we're going to have to grapple with. I think you've done an excellent job identifying them and explaining them to us. And I feel like I'm almost at the point where I can make the green light, red light decision, which you're asking us to make. So I thank you for that. But the third, I want to pose a question. And it's the question that I posed to our CFO when we met last to talk about this. And let me offer a homey analogy. I'm pretty sure with one of my credit cards that I could buy a new car with what I have left on a card. But I'm also really sure I couldn't buy a new car and renovate our kitchen. So, and my wife is gone for the next year and left me instructions to renovate our kitchen. So I have to make a choice. I can't do both. My preference would be to sell the house or have it condemned by the city. But I mean, we're looking at all the options. Maybe a work session on that, Mayor, would be helpful. But I have to make a choice of what kind of debt I incur, and good debt, bad debt, and the sequence of debt. And when I look at the infrastructure demands section of your handout, there's some real big ticket items. And my guess is that if you forced every member of council to do a forced ranking, we would come up with a different sequence. Now, the reason that the Portland Building Reconstruction is here is because we have a great tradition in local government of taking things up as they come. And so it's in the queue. And so we got a $200 million challenge, and we're asking our finance team to be really creative about how we finance that. But you know, if we had a debt service on a bond of $6 million a year, and we could put $180 million into addressing homelessness, or our first phase of our of what is our likely cost on Superfund, or to a Rose Quarter redevelopment, we have to ask some tough questions about what comes first, cost benefit, and with each project, my sense is that the financing for the next project is going to become more complicated. And at a certain point, you're like me, where you're tapped out. You have to choose between the car, the home, or something else. So I guess really my question is to Ken. Can you give us, just at a very high level, a framework for calling that question? Because the assumption here is that we're either going to do this project or not. But I think if you get to the 30,000 foot level, There's with every decision of this magnitude, there is an opportunity cost, there is an impact on your ability to finance the next project, and I really don't have as good a sense as I think I should as a decision maker about how this impacts everything else in the queue, and how to decide which really is our first and most urgent priority.
Can I make a color commentary on your comment before? Well, give Ken a chance to think about his answer. The Portland building isn't before you because we sat back and thought, hey, isn't this a great idea? It's here because of leaks, construction problems, difficulties we have with it that we thought you got to deal with. I mean, that was sort of came upon us. And then you heard the logic on, we've got the leaks, we might just as well do the seismic. So one way or another, a Portland building has to be dealt with. And then the question is how best to deal with it. I'm not sure that you want to incur the risk of not doing anything, and I'm now thinking about data center disaster recovery and what could happen in terms of city operations, or the implications of the continued leaking. I mean, so this one moved itself up before perhaps Memorial Coliseum or Portland Harbor is still out there.
But I disagree, Fred, and I think that is the policy question that the council needs to discuss. I'm not actually sure that I want Kent to give us an answer in the 5 minutes left, because that is the key question, a memorial coliseum. I was actually going to say it makes the memorial coliseum look cheap at this point, the fixes to that. And plus, people love the memorial coliseum a lot more than they love the Portland building for the most part. So I think that is the question.
And in fairness to my question, I have never asked Ken to answer the question. What I've asked Ken to do is tell me the questions that I should be, because he's our CFO. And once he finances this, the next project in the queue becomes a little more challenging and on and on. So I've asked Ken to essentially offer me the framework of, as a decision maker, what are the questions I need to ask? And Fred, I totally agree with what you just said, but I'm simplifying it to the extent I'm saying, let's assume we had $175 million to spend in the next 5 years. What would we spend it on? And you're going to say that building's about to fall and it's leaky and our employees are at risk. Commissioner Saltzman is going to say that someone's dying every day on our streets. Steve's going to say that we're about to become like, you know, Armageddon with our streets. At a certain level, we have all these urgent needs. And what I don't want to lose track of is that when we finance something of this significance, it has an impact on our ability to do another project or the timing of another project. And I'm only posing the question, what's the framework for us to make that judgment? Not what he thinks, but what are the questions that he thinks we should ask?
Because actually we have city employees in much worse conditions than the Portland building. So that, I think, needs to be factored in as well.
Yeah. Well, certainly it's a complicated issue, and there's not an easy answer to it. If it was an easy answer to it, we would have already implemented it. We have competing priorities. We have legacy liabilities that we've known about for a long time. Superfund is not a new thing. The condition of the Portland building really isn't a new thing. The deterioration of the street system really isn't a new thing. A lot of these things are issues that have been circling for us, and now they're beginning to come home to roost, whether we want them to land yet or not. How do we make good, smart decisions? That's what we're going to have to roll up our sleeves and figure out. What are those priorities? Portland building is home to 1,300 people. It delivers substantial services to our citizens. If it's compromised by future events, seismic or otherwise, how are we going to provide those services? That's something that we need to think long and hard about, even if it comes at a high price tag. How do we fairly deal with the legacy liability like the Superfund, which we know is coming at us? Coliseum, you know, the veteran, that area, that's to me a little bit easier. It's a nice to have. We aren't obligated to do things. There are things that we would like to do. Is there a way to find a plan that brings more private capital to bear, something that makes more sense for us in terms of moving the needle, economic development or otherwise for us? Things like the post office project, if we're smart and do that project right, we get an asset. We can take advantage of our capacity to borrow and fund things and create value that helps us build some of these other things down the road if we're patient. It's those kinds of ideas and policies and thoughts that we're going to have to wrestle with. There's not a single answer. I don't have it. I can advise you as how we work through this, but it's going to take us working collectively as to what are those things that are most important and how do we look at not just today, but 5 or 10 years down the road and see how we can start making that happen. And it may take more resources for us to do all those things if we want to do them sooner versus later.
I think we'd all appreciate, and I appreciate that answer, I think we'd all appreciate, at least I would, a more holistic discussion of what is the order of doing things and how we're going to pay for things. I know our time is up. I am disappointed we didn't get to the public involvement because that, to me, is one of the key points. And I hope that we will remember that, as Commissioner Fish said, this is a public building and that we make it welcoming and that we include people in the community on our various committees and such, because looking at the 1900 building, it's not at all customer friendly, in my opinion, in terms of visiting. And over time, the Portland building has become less and less friendly as we've barricaded ourselves behind locked doors and such. So I hope that we are sensitive, that we include people from the community in figuring out how it works, not just the employees.
Any other closing comments by our advisors, some of whom haven't gotten to say very much at this point? So give you the chance for the last word or two.
I just want to emphasize really the opportunity here. I recognize there's a lot of competing interests for funding. This is a really important building in the city, and there have been multiple occasions where people have kind of asked, where is Portland in terms of leadership and sustainability, green building? And I think that there's this convergence of opportunities here when it comes to reconstructing this facility as a resilient facility for the city. And so